Set change. Thank you, Casey. Hi, guys. It's really good to be with you. It's good to see you all. I haven't been here for a couple weeks, and I've missed y'all. Can I start with a story this morning? John Ortberg, he's an author and a pastor, he tells a story about Dallas Willard, who was a friend of his for a long time. If you don't know who Dallas Willard is, he's sort of an icon of the last 50 years in the Christian world, as somebody who thinks deeply about spiritual formation. How do we become formed in the image of Christ? And he wrote a lot of books and was very, very influential, passed away just a few years ago. And Dallas Willard is not only influential in the Christian world for his work in spiritual formation, but he was a philosophy professor at the University of California. And many people suppose that his influence in the world of philosophy actually exceeds his influence in the world of Christianity. That he was widely respected for his work in philosophy, especially in a philosopher named Hegel, and he would teach all over the world in academic settings on these topics. And he would teach, of course, lots of philosophy classes. And John Ortberg tells the story of going to visit Dallas Willard in class. And it's a lecture hall filled with a couple hundred students, all taking their general education philosophy class. And so they're going over different philosophical ideas and problems and questions and ethics and all these things. And John Ortberg tells this story that they've had this brilliant discussion led by Dallas, where he's giving some really thoughtful and profound and perhaps life-changing responses to some really profound philosophical questions in this room of students who aren't necessarily believers in Jesus. And he tells the story that as the class is winding down, this first-year student stands up to answer a question and or to pose a question, and just kind of arrogantly tries to demolish everything Dallas is saying. And the way John Ortberg tells the story, that his argument isn't even that good. It's not a very sound argument. And John Ortberg is thinking, I could, in a few sentences, I could tear this kid's philosophy apart. Dallas surely is going to shut him down, show him where he's wrong, and then tell what we really should be thinking. And this kid is kind of has this vibe of you know, kind of know-it-all sort of sense. So John Ortberg is just ready for this moment that Dallas is going to just show him where he's wrong. And this kid gets done speaking, and Dallas kind of takes a breath, and he looks at the room, and he says, "And I think that's a good place to end for the day. We'll see you next class." And John Ortberg is like, "No, that kid needs to be put in his place. He needs to be told. He needs to be explained why he's wrong. And not just like for our sake, because he was annoying, but like for his sake. Like, he's going down the wrong path. Someone needs to solve this, right?" And he tells the story that Dallas and he went out to lunch after class, and he asked him, why did you let that kid get away with that? Like, is that really what's good for the class? Is that really what's good for him? And Dallas just looked at him and he said, "Oh, I'm practicing the discipline of not having the last word. I'm practicing the discipline of not having the last word." Today we're going to talk about love is not arrogant or rude. And I just want to warn you, as we think deeply about arrogant or rude, as I've been thinking as deeply as I can this week about arrogant or rude, I found that to really dive into this might ruin some of your favorite pleasures. Some pretty simple ones. I really like this really specific thing. I really like British soccer documentaries. Weird, right? It's true. It's true. And I was watching one this week, the series this week of, there's a lot of them out there. It turns out it's a whole, like, genre. There's a lot of them out there. You can watch these series following, like, a team through a season. I love these things. I was watching one this week, and as I thought deeply about arrogant or rude, it sort of ruined the experience for me, because I was like, oh, there's arrogance all over the place. Oh, wow, okay. It might ruin some of your other favorite pleasures, like the pleasure of being right. I found that to be true this week. For some of you know that I teach at a university, and I direct theater at a university, so I have lots of students who I would like them to know that I'm right. And I found that as I think deeply about arrogant or rude, that pleasure has sort of begun to drain from that. It might ruin some of your other pleasures, the other favorite pleasures, which is perhaps controlling the lives of other people. I've noticed this week that as I've tried to get people to behave in certain ways, it stopped being quite so fun when I win. I've noticed this week that a lot of the things that I thought were just normal human behavior actually might be rooted in a place of needing to have the last word, needing to be the one to speak the final word on whatever situation, in whatever scenario. So I appreciate Dallas's practice, his discipline of not having the last word, of choosing to let everyone, 200 students in the room, think that he's wrong, that this student is right. It's remarkable. And I've discovered that so often, the things that I really pursue in my life can actually have a little bit more to do with ego than I would like to admit. So just warning, if that's not your cup of tea this morning, that's not what you're hoping to experience or go through this morning, I won't be offended when you leave. But let's read the whole passage that we're in, 1 Corinthians 13, where this, so we get some context for this arrogant or rude business. So all 13 verses of 1 Corinthians 13 says this: if I speak in tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I'm a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but I have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing. It rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, we prophesy in part. But when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. But when I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. So now faith, hope, and love abide, these three, but the greatest of these is love. So we've talked about this passage quite a bit the last few weeks and how Paul is describing the essential nature of love in the Christian life. In fact, if we take Jesus seriously, he says that his whole goal, the whole thing he's come to do, is to teach us how to love well, to love God and to love others, which for him are two inseparable things. Make us loving people. That's the goal of following Jesus, to shape us in the way of love. And we've talked a little bit about how love in this passage is not necessarily an emotion, right? It's a way of being. It's not necessarily a warm, fuzzy feeling of affection. It can have that effect. It can generate that. But love itself is actually a way of being in relationship to God and to other people. We've also talked about, this is really important. This is really important because if you're like me, you come to this passage and you immediately hear a list of things you're failing at, right? I've already mentioned a few of the things I'm failing at this morning. But we have talked about this passage in the light of God being love. So if I want to become more loving, I first have to recognize that God actually embodies all of these things. And hopefully week by week, we're gazing at the beauty of God. We're gazing at his incredible love, his love which is patient and kind, his love which does not envy or boast, his love which is not arrogant or rude. That love, we are gazing at his love week by week by week and being formed after the image of the love of God. So I think that's important for us to recognize that while we want to grow in love, we have to recognize that this is also God's disposition towards us. And so we can all kind of breathe a sigh of relief. Like if at the end of today we realize that a lot of what we're doing or some of what we're doing or is the way we're treating people or the way we're thinking about whatever is based on arrogant and rude, that we can breathe a sigh of relief and recognize like, it's okay because God's disposition towards me is patient and kind, right? And all these things that we've been discussing. But I really want to focus in on these two words, arrogant and kind. And they're a bit tricky because I think we have kind of caricatures of these in our heads. But for me, like I was like, oh yeah, arrogant. I know what that feels like. I know what it feels like to be cocky and to sort of like be that, think you're the big cheese. I don't know, is that a phrase? The big cheese. And I know what that feels like, and I don't think I really experience that very often, and so like I don't know how big of a part arrogance plays in my life, but I'm also aware that there are subtler versions of arrogant and rude, right? Because I thought about my behavior, and I was like, I'm not really rude. Like, I'm known among my students and my friends as generally a gracious person. Like, I don't tend to, like, fly off the handle at people. So clearly, I'm not, like, a rude person. But then I also, as I've been really thinking deeply, recognize that there are subtler versions of all of these. And kind of what I've come to, and I'll show you where I get this in the scriptures in a moment, but sort of what I've come to is this, that arrogance is putting myself in the place of God. That sounds like an extreme statement, but I'll show you how that plays out. Arrogance is putting myself in the place of God, okay? And rudeness, at least I think as Paul means it in this passage, rudeness tends to come when my arrogance is not respected. When me putting myself in the place of God is not respected, I can respond with rudeness, even if it's a quote-unquote polite rudeness. And so I've been mulling these things over, and what does it mean to like forego arrogance? What does it mean to forego rudeness? And I kind of stumbled upon or kind of was drawn to a passage in Philippians, a famous passage, which describes what I would say is the opposite of arrogant or rude. It describes humility, and specifically it describes Jesus's humility, okay? Jesus's humility. And this is a famous passage. Perhaps you've like learned this one by heart or you've read it a bunch of times before. It's quite famous. And it's in Philippians chapter 2. And it's we'll start in verse 4. This is Paul's letter to the church, to the people who are Christians in Philippi. It says this, "Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Have this in mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God," or some translations say, "was in very nature God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped." So Jesus, the mind we're supposed to have, is the mind of Christ, who, though he was in very nature God, did not consider equality with God a thing to be grasped. Now, the implication here is that it is possible to walk through life having the opposite attitude, right? Like Paul's saying, have this attitude as opposed to its opposite. So what would the opposite be? So it's possible to walk through my life being in very nature not God and yet considering equality with God a thing to be grasped. And as I sort of reverse the words, you ever do that with scripture, reverse the words and see if it illuminates something for you? As I sort of reverse the words, I recognized, oh no, wait a minute. What would that mean in my own life? So being in very nature not God, considering equality with God a thing to be grasped. And I started to recognize that there are some ways in my life in which I really want to be equal with God. So I mentioned one already. I want to be right. I want to have the final word on what is truth for somebody else or for myself or, right, for the community. I want to be right. And the crazy thing is, I might be right, but it's that wanting to be right that is that desiring to be equal with God, that needing to be seen to be right, needing others to assent to my rightness, and certainly not doing what Dallas Willard did and allowing a room full of people to leave thinking you're wrong, without speaking up. So I was like, okay, well, maybe in that sense, but is there any other sense in which I, though I am in very nature not God, consider equality with God a thing to be grasped? And I realized that in my industry, which is the performing industry, I've worked really, really hard to build up a strong career in that field. It's a very, very competitive place to be. And when you live in a competitive industry, sometimes you can really get addicted to people praising your work and people kind of being amazed at your talent and people really, really wanting you on their team for their project. And I started to think, hang on. If God is the only one worthy of praise, then is there a sense in which I ever put myself in the place of God by needing, demanding praise, accolades, to make people's jaws drop, right? And it's not wrong for me to do the performing that I do. Of course not. Like, that's my industry. That's what God made me to do. That's what I've, like, been created in this world to be doing for the glory of God. And yet I notice there's a part of me that also really seems to, like, get off on this praise, the applause, the jaws dropping in the audience. Oh, no. Am I, who is in very nature not God, putting myself in the place of God? And I started to really consider that. There's another really subtle way in which sometimes I've noticed that I can put myself in the place of God or consider equality with God a thing to be grasped. And it has to do with especially my students. I have a lot of students, and if you know any college, a lot of college folks right now, it's a really anxious time to be in college and to be in that age range, and there's a lot of anxiety going around, a lot of overwhelmedness going around, and so I often have students in my office hours just like crying and talking about what's going on and how can I get caught up, and I'm so overwhelmed, and is this the right career for me, and all these sorts of questions. And I can really get caught up in the idea that it is my job to take care of the well-being of all of these students, and like I am responsible for their spiritual and emotional health. And I suddenly started to go, wait. If I think that I can be all things to all people, is that just like another way of trying to make myself equal with God? And you might be sitting there being like, Ben, geez, lighten up. Like, don't go so hard on yourself. But I promise this is going somewhere beautiful. Because when we put ourselves in that position where it's like, I will be right and everyone will see that I'm right and I will make sure that everyone else knows like what they need to be doing and how they need to be and what they need to be about and how they need to think about this. Or when I say, I must have praise, I must have accolades, I must have applause, I must have these things in order to feel well in the world, and we sort of maneuver ourselves and manipulate ourselves to getting those things. Or when I say, I must be all things to all people, I must solve your problem and your problem and your problem and your problem, I must be the one who can fix it. When I do that, first of all, I'm carrying an immense burden of responsibility on my shoulders. And secondly, when those things don't happen, I can become rude. Love is not arrogant, it is also not rude. And when people don't agree that I'm right, I can shut them down. Even if I do it with a smile and a polite word. We get real good at this. And when people don't give me the applause and the praise, I can talk about another actor behind their back, about how they're really not as good as they think they are and they shouldn't be getting all that applause. Or another, you fill in the blank in your world. And if I really think that I can fix every problem, then when a student doesn't want help, or when I solve a problem but then it comes back up, I can be affronted and my response can be, well, you just weren't listening. You clearly didn't intake what I told you because that would have fixed all your problems. I can become quite rude. And to be honest, I don't want to live that way. I don't want to feel that way. I don't want to treat people that way. I don't want to have that automatic response to people. And Jesus shows me a better way, because he, being in very nature God, so Jesus, being the one who was right about everything and right about like my life and like has the right to tell me what is true and good for my life, right? Jesus, being the one who does deserve praise, the one who said that if the people don't praise me, the rocks and the trees will cry out. Jesus, being the one who actually is the answer to every human ill, the one who can fix every problem in this room, Jesus even chose not to make equality with God a thing to be grasped. Well, what did he do instead? Verse 7 of Philippians chapter 2, but he emptied himself. He emptied himself, taking the very form of a servant and being born in the likeness of men. and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross. He let death, over which he had total power, win. He let it kill him. What? That's the way? This is a dark sermon, Ben. This is kind of sad. Jesus, being in very nature God, did not try to use equality with God or grasp equality with God or be seen to be equal with God. Instead, he did what? Emptied himself. Other translations say this: he made himself nothing. Do you ever feel like you're just desperately trying to make something of yourself? In relationship, in career, in your spiritual life? To really make something of yourself? Jesus made himself nothing. He emptied himself. It's a powerful image. Jesus, the one who has authority and is in very nature God, instead of choosing arrogance, which then when thwarted results in rudeness, Jesus emptied himself. What did he empty himself of? Let's find out together. It says this: being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death. Being found in human form, he humbled himself, becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed him on him the name above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. So we get two pictures here. He emptied himself of something. He didn't claim equality with God. And in the end, what did he get? The name above every name. So he emptied himself and didn't count equality with God a thing to be grasped, and in the end, he got equality with God. Wait, how's that work? Jesus emptied himself. I've been thinking about this all week long. Here's what I think is going on. Jesus emptied himself of his own ability to define significance and identity for himself. And what did he gain? Identity bestowed. He did not grasp at being known, seen, admired, and all those things were given to him. This is the crazy thing, y'all. This passage is actually a gift and not just a burden. Because when I try to make something of myself, it'll always slip through my fingers. There will always be someone better. I will always be having relational trouble with somebody. I will never quite achieve the things I really want. I won't ever quite feel close enough. When I try to make something of myself, I will always be thwarted. It will always slip through my fingers. The only identity that really reaches down to the bottom of my soul and convinces me deep in my bones that I am beloved is the identity which is bestowed upon me. Jesus emptied himself so that he could be filled by his Father. Jesus emptied himself and made himself nothing so that his Father could lift him up and make him quite something. And this is the pathway I think we're invited into. It's a pathway of humility, of dying to ourselves, and it sounds quite harsh, but let me ask you this. How is the burden of yourself sitting on your shoulders right now? Do you ever find yourself tired of thinking about your own desires, pathway, fulfillment, self-actualization? Do you ever just get sick of your own company? Jesus is like, how about let it go? How about give it up? How about stop needing to be right or to fix things or to control things or to get accolades? How about just put down the burden? It's just too heavy. And I'll give you a light burden and an easy yoke by bestowing your true identity on you. I wonder if Jesus isn't trying to give us an impossible task. I wonder if he's trying to liberate us to free us from the burden of ourselves and the need to make something of ourselves. I wonder if he's trying to free us from building our own little castle and kingdom into the glorious freedom of his kingdom, where we are called beloved and where the Spirit of God, according to Romans chapter 5, is poured with love into our hearts to convince us deep down on like a bone molecular level that we are accepted and loved. And in that place, there is confidence and security, but not arrogance. Arrogance is a burden, friends. I think all of us in our truest, most honest moments know this. How many of us have had arrogance ruin a day because we didn't get the praise we wanted? How many of us have had arrogance ruin a relationship because we had to be right? How many of us have had arrogance make us feel like a loser because we couldn't fix so-and-so's problem? And Jesus is saying, what if you didn't carry that burden? What if you gave up the burden of yourself and allowed me to give you a new self? Well, this just sounds kind of extreme, Ben. Where are you getting all this? I'm getting it from Jesus when he says, those who seek to save their life will lose it. But those who just give it up, no, I won't make my own life. I won't make my own identity. I won't make my own way. I won't base my worth on these things. Then they will save their life. They will gain their life in the way of Jesus. I think Jesus is not trying to beat us over the heads or give us an impossible task. I think he's trying to liberate us. Listen to this. Oh, man, well, while we're talking about like extreme words and phrases, let me give you a little quote from Thomas A Kempis. You guys know Thomas A Kempis? He wrote one of the greatest devotional classics of the history of Christianity. In the Middle Ages, he was a monk and a priest, and he wrote a book called The Imitation of Christ. And this book is a dialogue between the voice of Christ and the voice of the disciple. So the voice of Christ speaks, and then the voice of the disciple responds. And this is the voice of Christ speaking about liberty and peace. Listen to what it says. It says, my child, I will teach you the way of peace and true liberty. Ooh, peace and true liberty. Yes, please. Can I have some? Well, listen to what he says. Seek, child, to do the will of others rather than your own. Oh, that sounds a little less fun. Always choose to have less rather than more. Oh, hang on a minute. But my Amazon shopping cart is pretty full. It actually is. Look always for the last place and seek to be beneath all others. Well, but what about like self-esteem? Always wish and pray that the will of God be fully carried out in you. Behold, such will enter into the realm of peace, rest, and liberty. Thomas A Kempis, I think, saw what Jesus and his New Testament followers who wrote the New Testament letters understood, which is that this journey that many of us just kind of live in without thinking, because it's the air we breathe, right? This journey of trying to make something of ourselves in relationships, in our careers, in whatever realm, is actually a prison. It's a hamster wheel. It's an endless cycle of trying and failing and trying and failing and trying and failing and then lashing out in rudeness. And I think Thomas A Kempis and Paul and Jesus are trying to liberate us from that endless loop and say, you don't have to play this game. You can have confidence and security that are bestowed rather than an arrogance that is clutched at and grasped for. You can lose yourself. In the process, you will find freedom. And when I begin to think about it like that, I'm like, oh, Jesus isn't trying to hurt me. He's trying to free me. Like, he wants me to live the way of peace and true liberty. He wants me to walk through the world like, okay. He wants me to walk through the world feeling okay. That, like, I know I'm secure, I know I'm loved, and I don't have to do anything, and no one else needs to think I'm right, and no one else needs to listen to my advice, and no one else needs to tell me I'm amazing, because Jesus has done that for me. That is the way of true peace and liberty. That is the way of humility. My favorite writer, G.K. Chesterton. You all know G.K. Chesterton? Check out, look at this. I have G.K. Chesterton on my keychain. That's him right there. G.K. Chesterton is an amazing writer from about 100 years ago, and he has a lot of amazing quips and one-liners. And one of the things that he says in a book that he wrote called Heretics, great title for a book, is, "It is always the secure who are humble." It is always the secure who are humble. And we often think of humility as people being insecure, right? Like, oh, I don't really know, and oh, no, I won't tell you what I think because I don't know, and right? The insecurity tends to sort of get blended with humility, but he says, that, no, it's actually the secure who are humbled. And what he's talking about in that passage or in that essay, what he's talking about is that when we have a true security, not a false arrogance, but a true security in Jesus, when we lose ourselves and allow him to give us our true self, our true identity, then we are deeply, profoundly secure, and we may live free and humble. We may live loving. We may love freely. We just give. Just love. Just accept. Just receive people as they are and not as they should be or as we think they should be. When we have that true security instead of that false arrogance. This, now we're sort of cycling back to the idea that love actually comes from God because God is love. This is something that is really parsed out really in detail in the letter of 1 John. Right? 1 John is called the letter of love sometimes. And in 1 John 4:19, there's this famous statement that we've brought up before in this series where John says, "We love because he first loved us." We love because he first loved us. And if you're like, well, Ben, it sounds like I get what you're saying about the freedom and the liberty of like losing yourself and receiving your true identity from Jesus. I get it. And giving up the need to be right or to be praised or to fix all the problems. Like, I get it. But how do we do it? And here's the delightful part, you guys. It actually has very little to do with strenuous effort. It has very little to do with your willpower. It has very little to do with adding more things to your schedule. You know what it has to do with? It has to do with he loved, we love because he has loved us, right? We love because he first loved us, first loved us. So do you want to have the freedom of humility? First, let God love you. If I don't hear every single day what God thinks of me and who he says I am in Jesus Christ, I will live that day according to the law of arrogance. And when I am not treated the way I think I should be treated, I will become rude. But if I choose to listen every day, multiple times a day, to the voice that says, "You are my beloved. I love you. This is who you are." Then I can begin little by little, to give up my need to be right. To give up my need to tell other people where they're wrong. To give up my need for praise. To give up my need to fix the problems of everybody around me. I have the potential to become truly humble to the degree that I listen to the God who calls me beloved. I think that's the way. I think that's the way towards love and towards freedom. That's what I've been thinking about this week. It's been wild. I invite you to think about it with me in the coming week ahead. In a moment, we're going to take communion, and what a great opportunity to practice losing ourselves and receiving our identity from Jesus. The ancient Christians, the church fathers, people like Augustine and others talk about communion or the Eucharist, the place of this sacrament that we've been doing for thousands of years. They talk about the table as a place where we come empty-handed. We hold nothing. We hold nothing. You don't have to be right. You don't have to be pure. You can come empty-handed. And the only requirement is to be ready to receive from Jesus. So if you're like, I don't know if I believe in Jesus. I don't know if I believe that like he can wash me and cleanse me and like tell me really who I am in God. Like, I don't know if that's how I think of Jesus. No worries. If you're not ready to receive from Jesus this morning, like, no worries. Stay in your seat. No one will think it's weird. But if you want to come empty-handed and admit, like, I don't have anything in and of myself. I really don't know the answers to all the world's questions or all of my questions or all my friends' questions. I really don't know who I really am. But Jesus, you do. If you're ready to receive this morning the affirmation of Christ, of who you are because of his body broken for us and his blood shed for us, then you can come to one of these two stations. Gluten-free is on this side over here. And you can take your bread and you can dip it in the juice and remember that his broken body and his shed blood is actually what gives us that true security so we can abandon all that false, anxious arrogance. Let me pray for us. Jesus, thank you for your word. Lord, I just want to confess that it's so easy for me to hear things that you're trying to give me for my own freedom as condemnation and as obligation. So would you protect us from that this morning, Lord? Would you help us to hear the joyful call towards freedom? Jesus, you're not judging us for our false arrogance, so would you help us not to judge ourselves? And instead, just to look to you and say, God, who am I? Beyond my need for being right, beyond my need for praise, beyond my need for fixing other people, who am I? Would you tell us this morning? We love you, Jesus, and we thank you. In your name, amen. The tables are open.